opening with dance-like music of Mason Bates and an excerpt from one of four Bagatelles featured in the release by the Del Sol Quartet for their Scrapyard Exotica release. Dance music of all sorts will be central to the next performances at the performance venue Gray Area on Mission Street this Saturday, January 25th at 7:30. As the most performed contemporary composer of his generation, Mason Bates dons his hat as DJ Masonic, impresario, and DJ composer for Mercury Soul. Dance floor ready sets by DJ Masonic, as well as DJ Justin Reed, will bloom into unforgettable classical performances featuring legendary ODC dance. There'll be music by Chopin, Mozart, John Adams, Bach, Mendelssohn, and Piazzolla, plus the premiere of brand new interludes composed specifically for the event by Grammy-winning composer, someone I'm pleased to call my friend as well, Mason Bates. Mason, welcome back to On the Arts.
Great to be here.
And congrats on more of those frequent flyer miles that go to special repeat guests on this show. I hope you're spending them well.
Absolutely.
Well, let's do a little catch up before we talk about this Saturday's performance. Work is well underway for the opera we teased our listeners some time ago about, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. Although, as I understand, not as originally planned with LA to start things off. Tell us about the little bit of a change in plans for that opera.
Well, we're going to open that season at Metropolitan Opera in September with this opera based on the novel by Michael Chabon, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, is about these Jewish cartoonists living in New York in the 40s. They're trying to make enough money to save their family, which is being persecuted in Europe during the war. So it's got a lot of big American themes from, you know, kind of the cultural impact of immigrants to, you know, kind of pop culture and obviously war and tragedy. We were going to give a premiere at LA Opera that fell through. Apparently sometimes financial issues rear their ugly heads in the world of performing arts. But actually we had a great time doing the piece at Indiana University, which has, I don't know if you know this, they have like a replica of the Met stage. They have a massive stage, their massive opera program, you know, like 1600 strong music school. So it was actually kind of a nice place to bring the piece to life away from critics, no offense, David, but you know, sometimes we wanna do things before anybody reports on them. So that was cool. We learned some stuff about the show. Obviously I need to tighten some things up. Every opera needs to be a little tighter. So yeah, I'm still finishing up some orchestration edits and some stuff like that.
Well, I really enjoyed the Michael Chabon 2001 Pulitzer Prize winning novel. And thanks for familiarizing us again with what to look forward to in the plot. Really, it's a fascinating story. Tell us about how the cast is shaping up, or is it all very firmly in place by this time?
Well, it's in place. I think it's, you know, one of these like top secret things until they announce in 2 weeks. But I will just say the story is really about young people, like people in their 20s trying to be cartoonists in New York. So from the beginning, the Met was like, we're going to be getting the next generation of amazing singers, but it's not going to be an opera like, you know, Kevin Putz's The Hours that had like, you know, Joyce DiDonato and Renee Fleming. It's really going to be about people who are in their 30s. So awesome singers, but it's not like we're going to resurrect Luciano Pavarotti or anything like that.
What is Chabon's involvement, or is his involvement done at this point?
Well, Michael's involvement is he wrote the novel, and he very graciously gave the blessing for us to do this adaptation. But, you know, he's not really involved in the show. You know, Michael Chabon is like a master of the universe. He's show running stuff in Hollywood. He's obviously got his empire of novels and whatnot. So he kind of knows what he doesn't know. And he told me, you know, opera is not my thing, but you all go and do a good thing with it. So Gene Shear, our librettist, is really the person who's transforming this book into the stage adaptation. And, you know, we hope Michael likes it. But, you know, opera is a different beast. And in order to make a novel work on stage and be true to that novel, you do have to change things.
Indeed. So it must be occupying a lot of your time, and I imagine your wife is grateful that you're taking some family duties now while you're in town. Hence, you're requesting an early slot on the art so you can take care of some kids' issues.
Yeah, exactly.
So I imagine your life is packed with jetting around the globe, witnessing wonderful performances of your works. What else would you like to share with us about either new works or some exciting places that are offering your music?
Well, honestly, right now I'm so focused on the upcoming Mercury Soul Show because each one of these events is really like a mini wedding or something. Mercury Soul, takes classical music, mixes it with DJs in spaces like clubs, or will take Grace Cathedral and transform it, or the US Mint or the Hibernian Bank. And so it's kind of like colliding a classical concert with some kind of a party. And there are many, many moving parts. So we're really excited about this one, this coming Saturday, the 25th at Gray Area. It's a new venue for us. And also, we're working with the most incredible dance company, ODC.
And what are the other, I mentioned some of the composers involved, all traditional arrangements of those works, or are they kind of a modern take on them?
Some of them are reimagined. There's a Chopin nocturne that ODC Dance has a beautiful piece of choreography to that involves the entire company, choreographed by Brenda Ray. And it is the Chopin nocturne, but it's kind of recomposed in a kind of a minimal way with sort of electronic elements. But I will have to say what we do kind of pride ourselves on at Mercury Soul is that when these new audiences come to experience some of them classical music for the first time, we do want them to hear the actual classical music. And so when they hear the Mendelssohn song with words, without words, they're going to hear that piece as it was written. Or we have several bourrées from Bach cello suites. We have Mozart clarinet concerto that's arranged for string clarinet, and several pieces by Piazzolla. The whole concert is really, it's really an event, not like a concert, not seated, but it's about dance. Music's kind of, response to dance, sometimes literally, like in the Piazzolla Libre Tango, or sometimes more abstractly, like in the piece you just heard, Scrapyard Exotica, which has like samples of a string quartet accompanying the string quartet itself.
And a really amazing highlight of the Mercury Souls that I've attended is the visuals. Tell us about some of the work that is being offered by visual designer Mark Johns that'll take over the whole surrounding walls.
Well, I'm glad you noticed. It started as a way to communicate program information to the audience in a way that was non-invasive. So, we just have like program, information, composer title, notes on the walls. We decided we'd just turn that into really like an artistic piece. And so it's become this kind of immersive, super vibey, free-flowing kind of transformative art that's going throughout the event. It does bloom into these program notes. One of the things about classical music for people that are uninitiated, people seem to be pretty intimidated, like, oh gosh, I don't know enough about it. Even like really smart people. You don't have to know all the background. I mean, if you're alive, a lot of this music will blow your mind. But it's useful to know what you're hearing, know a little bit about it. And so I've been fascinated with how can you get information to the audience in new ways. Our traditional concert halls aren't going anywhere. Those are the most perfect places to hear classical music. But if we can get it out into different spaces and kind of give people a gateway, then, maybe they'll go and check out something at the symphony and hear Bernard Markel this weekend, that kind of thing. So information is key, and designing that information is a passion.
You've been key in getting all kinds of new audiences to hear not only your music, but music in the classical concert hall. And I encourage you to keep up that work because I know you will. Best of luck with the premiere and the preparations for the next opera and the Met. Dust off that tux. Not that it's getting any dust at all the way you're traveling around. So great to talk with you again. And a reminder that KALW followers, yes, you can get a discounted ticket by using the promo code KALW for 20% off the ticket price for this Saturday at mercurysoul.com/ODC. Thanks, Mason. We'll talk again soon. Go get those kids. Let's go out with the music of John Adams. We'll talk later, Mason.
Yeah, thank you.
One of the pieces that will be featured in the shows this weekend at for Mercury Soul, John's Book of Alleged Dances, and another esteemed quartet and good friends of KLW, the Kronos Quartet. And then some more symphonic works with Sir Mark Elder. Stay with us. Appropriate that we've ended that segment with music of John Adams, who has enjoyed an especially long and fruitful relationship with the San Francisco Symphony. In fact, his piano concerto, After the Fall, just had its debut last week with David Robertson on this podium with the San Francisco Symphony and the superb Icelandic pianist Víkingur Ólafsson as soloist. Adams' short work for orchestra, Short Ride in a Fast Machine, is included in the program this weekend at the Symphony that will be guest conducted by my guest, Sir Mark Elder, who makes his San Francisco Symphony debut in these performances. Mark Elder was music director of the Halle Orchestra from 2000 to 2024 and now holds the position of conductor emeritus. He was previously music director of the English National Opera and principal guest conductor of the BBC Symphony and City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. In 2023, he took up the post of principal guest conductor of the Bergen Philharmonic. Sir Mark has enjoyed a long relationship with the London Philharmonic and Symphony, as well as working with leading symphony orchestras and opera companies throughout the world. Last year, he made his 63rd appearance at the BBC Proms, arguably the world's greatest classical music festival. Maestro, welcome to On the Arts.
Well, it's lovely to share this with you, David.
And to the city of San Francisco. I'm sure you've visited before. I'm hoping you have a little bit of downtime.
Me too. I was here a few years ago. Was it 7 years ago? I did the longest opera ever written at the Opera House. The Master Singers of Nuremberg. And so I managed to scrape some time to get to know San Francisco. We stayed in Sausalito, so I came over that bridge every day.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed that and just getting to know the flavor of the city.
Mm-hmm. So surprisingly now just gracing the podium of the San Francisco Symphony.
Yeah, well, it's up to them to do the, inviting.
Right. I guess good things come to those who wait, as our San Francisco audiences will soon find out.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about how you shaped this program for which the symphony marketers are counting on, the Strauss, also Sprach Zarathustra, to draw people in.
Well, one of the first things that we discussed together was whether or not I would like to do a program without a soloist. And I do so many concertos, and I enjoy accompanying concertos enormously. And I thought it would be lovely, because I don't know the orchestra, to just be able to work with them and to break the ice with them and not have a soloist. And I thought that I should do work that I've been conducting all my life, but that would be associated with their style, with their sound. And it seemed to me that Zarathustra would fit the bill. And it, of course, has an incredible dance element to it as well. The whole of the second part just dances away into the ether. And I thought that I would do something that I have done in the past, but it really always goes down so well. The end of the Zarathustra is rather ambiguous. You can't quite tell, has it finished? What key are we in? It seems to evaporate. And the audiences are always mystified, not in America particularly, but all over the world. And so I thought, well, why don't I just do a little encore that will just keep everybody on their toes and give them a sort of unexpected extra treat? And I picked on this lovely work of Adams's because it's incredibly powerful and so fast. And my experience is it gets more applause than the Strauss.
Interesting. The interesting things about John Adams' Short Ride, it makes the list of the top 10 most performed symphonic works composed in the last 25 years. It was featured in the 2004, 14, and 19 at the Proms. Were you on the podium for any of those?
I may well have been. Yeah. I may well have done it once, but it was quite a long time ago.
And you know what he said about that, why it's called Short Ride in a Fast Machine and the feeling you're supposed to get?
Go on.
He wrote, you know how it is when someone asks you to ride in a terrific sports car and then you wish you hadn't.
Yes. That's right. Yeah, that's very good. But it has that feel, of course, breakneck.
Yeah, yeah, it's a wonderful piece. I'm wondering, I mentioned in my brief introduction your long relationship with the Halle Orchestra, with the end of the 23-24 season being another end of sorts. A very emotional June for you and the Manchester audiences, I imagine.
David, it was actually, and it wasn't just June. We did a number of concerts all over the country as a way to say goodbye to audiences who we'd become very close to. I'd always wanted to do this job, to have my own symphony orchestra in my own country. And over the years, you gradually build up a relationship with the public. And some are very strong and some are not so strong. But it's a very, very important part of music for me, is making the audience feel that the orchestra is there for them and that they get to know them. For instance, in Nottingham, it's a town in England that has a wonderful concert hall. And it has such an audience now. It has such a powerful, curious, loyal, passionate audience. And I shall miss them terrifically. And the orchestra and I have done so many things together. We've grown, we've changed. Things were not at all easy when I first started at the beginning of the century. Finances were really tricky. They'd come out of a slightly, hard time. And we've really managed to build it back. And I'm so proud of them and delighted that things are going well with my successor.
Well, I'm sure you will be making frequent appearances as a conductor emeritus, and they'll love you when you're back as they do now. You also had a bit of a scare back in 2019. You had to cancel a number of performances due to a neck injury. First of all, I hope you're fully recovered. What happened there?
Goodness, what an unexpected question. You are well informed. I needed to have a couple of joints in the back of my neck fused together. It's difficult to talk about after all these years. The nerve that runs down the side of my neck and down into my arm was inhibited by growth over time. The flow of the nerve was poor, and I was in a lot of discomfort. And I had this surgery to put all that right, which was totally successful, but it meant that I couldn't conduct for, I can't remember now, a couple of months, and I even came out of a new production of Death in Venice at Covent Garden. But everything's fine now, and I'm glad that it happened when it did.
That must have been extremely scary and frustrating. I'm so glad that things are back for you. We should give a little shout out to the other works on the program this weekend, and to the wonderful, fairly new principal flute, Yubin Kim, who'll have a nice opportunity to shine an oral spotlight on for the Debussy Prelude to the Afternoon of a Fawn.
I wanted, you see, to construct the first half of this program to showcase the orchestra's versatility, which I've known from years ago and on recordings. And Berlioz is one of my favorite composers. And his music has such incredible color and daring and individuality. And I thought, well, if I chose two pieces that people won't know, and like two slices of a very unusual loaf of bread, and then put in this languorous, sexy, you know, plenty of Chardonnay in the afternoon sort of piece of Debussy, it would make a nice first half that these three pieces would fit together. And of course, the flute has a time of it in the Debussy piece. I think it's one of the most important pieces for the 20th century, actually. It was written just at the end of the 19th, wasn't it? But it like paved the way to the way music might go in the 20th century. It was so brave and so original. Well, those two epithets, brave and original, apply to Hector Berlioz as well. He's one of the pieces that I'd love to, one of the composers I'd love to invite to dinner, you know, just to get to know him. He was a one-off man. And even these pieces come from the early part of his life. They are so original. They're so daring. And they both have similar shapes, a rather long, impressive introduction, dramatic and strong, and then a breakneck main part of the piece that goes really like the wind. I mean, both pieces are very fast. And that ties up, of course, with John's piece at the other end. So this program is sort of encased in very fast music. And I really look forward to working with the orchestra on this, to see how far we can get and whether we can get something really original. Because Berlioz, you know, he didn't play any instruments in the orchestra, and yet in the middle of his life, he wrote a treatise about how to orchestrate. It's typical of his extraordinary ability, his protean ability. He was an amazing man, very, very courageous and iconoclastic, and I just love his music, and I love the daring and the romance in it.
Having Mason Bates, composer, on earlier, I'm sure he is encouraged, as I hope all young composers are encouraged, to look to the works of Berlioz and to look to the orchestrations of Rimsky-Korsakov and Tchaikovsky as they're writing for orchestra. Because as a classical flutist, I've encountered scores that's like, what are they doing?
I know, it's true, isn't it? They're so original and so full of color. And yeah, the fact that they're dead white males must be brushed aside, and we must just open our ears and listen. And Berlioz is the best for that, because sometimes you can never tell what's coming around the corner. It was lovely to hear those noises from Mason Bates and John Ames. They were so beautiful. You just need to have an open heart, don't you, to take on stuff you don't know and take from it what you find. And the concept of music needing everybody to be clever, needing to know a lot, is something we must go on debunking forever and ever.
Well, I love your onophilic sense of programming and your culinary touch to the programming. We have the Chardonnay, we have the Burgundy, perhaps, of the Strauss, and I guess instead of a dessert wine, we'll have a schnapps with the Adams.
Something like that. Yeah, that's right. And I hope I can talk to the audience a bit about what's original about this program, too, because that's what's nice, to bring them in, you know, to open the door.
Always wonderful. Now, I think we're going to go out with the iconic Richard Strauss opening of also Sprach. Now, prior to 1968, when Stanley Kubrick decided to include it in his landmark film, 2001, A Space Odyssey, how often was the piece performed, and what was your first introduction to it?
I think the piece was very often performed. I think it was always an audience pleaser. What Kubrick did was just to bring the first 25 bars into an impossibly wide audience, people who would never have heard of Strauss or never would be aware of what he could contribute, as it were. And Kubrick used it because of the awesome quality, the solemnity of it, and it stuck with it. But of course, that's just 25 bars, David. There's another 40 minutes to come, full of extraordinary colors and extraordinary different sections that correspond to Nietzsche's famous book. And it's worth saying, isn't it, that at the end of the 19th century, that book had such a wide public. It's reading it now, which I've done a lot of it, it's difficult to see quite what it was about the book that got through to people so well. And Strauss was only one of many, many composers who found a lot in it. I think the poetry interested people. And Strauss has taken various sections talking about different topics in creation or in man's place in creation and constructed this enormously enjoyable and entertaining piece of music. And I love it. I've loved it all my life. I think the first time I heard it was certainly before Kubrick. I can't remember the exact year, but I can remember that it was the first of his tone poems that I ever conducted. When I had a chance to do something like that, and somebody said, well, what would you like to do? And I said, well, definitely, let's do Zarathustra, can't wait. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing to stand in front of that noise.
And it's a great time for audiences to hear the not often heard enough Davies Symphony Hall grand organ.
That's right, yeah, it sounds well. It sounds really good. We rehearsed it this morning and I hope it's not too loud. You mustn't drown out the orchestra.
Well, Sir Mark, have wonderful performances here. I look forward to seeing you at some point in your work on the podium and off. I'm hoping to hear some of your upcoming recording projects. Anything you want to share on that front?
Oh, sure. The other person who was really moved by Nietzsche's book, Also sprach Zarathustra, was the British composer Frederick Delius. Now, he's what we call a Marmite composer in England. I don't know whether that means anything over here, but a Marmite composer is a composer who you either hate or you love, like Marmite. Marmite, the sort of stuff we have on toast. And a lot of people hate it, a lot of people love it. Well, Delius fits into that. I think he's one of the great romantic composers. And one of the pieces he wrote was A Mass of Life, big piece for singers, orchestra, chorus, soloists, you know. And I made a recording of it a couple of years ago with one of my new groups of friends, the Bergen Philharmonic. And it's won a prize already in Norway, and it's up for other prizes. And I think that this work needs to be heard. It is so beautiful. It's so romantic and so thrilling, powerful, profound. And I'm going to even give it a go at the Proms next summer.
Fantastic. Well, that should be exciting. Sir Mark, thank you so much for taking some time. Enjoy your time in San Francisco. Hopefully enough downtime to sample the wines, maybe go over the bridge again.
Yep, I hope so.
We'll see you next time you're in town.
Thank you, David. Bye-bye.
Let's go out with a brief excerpt from Also sprach Zarathustra. You'll recognize it, the tone poem by Richard Strauss that will ring through Davies Symphony Hall this Friday, Saturday at 7:30, along with works by Hector Berlioz, Claude Debussy, and John Adams. Music of Richard Strauss. Again, this weekend's performance, Sir Mark Elder making his San Francisco Symphony debut on the podium for works of Claude Debussy, featuring Eubem Kim on Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, Hector Berlioz's overture to King Lear, the first San Francisco Symphony performances of that overture, Also sprach Zarathustra, and John Adams' Short Ride in a Fast Machine.
Just before our love got lost, you said, I am as constant as a northern star. And I said, constant in the darkness, where's that at? If you want me, I'll be in the bar. On the bed of a cartoon coaster, in the blue TV screen light, I drew a map of Canada. Oh, Canada, with your face sketched on it twice. You taste so bitter and you taste so sweet. Oh, I could drink a case of you, darling, and still be on my feet. I'd still be on my feet.
Those are the dulcet tones of my next guest and good friend, Ben Jones. They're with pianist Ron Abels from his 2023 release, I Think We Should See Other People, a collection of the breakup songs of Harold Arlen, Johnny Mercer, Julie Stein, Stephen Sondheim, and others, including that tune, Joni Mitchell's amazing A Case of You. Another artist is collaborating with Ben this Saturday as he and another powerhouse talent come together for an unforgettable night of music this Saturday at the Piedmont Piano Company in Oakland. Or rather, more like a cocktail hour, 5:30. Grammy Award-winning jazz pianist, composer, and arranger Lawrence Hobgood, and overdue for a Grammy, the aforementioned critically acclaimed vocalist Ben Jones. They'll share the stage to celebrate their mutual love of music, ranging across the Great American Songbook, Broadway, pop, classical music, and maybe a little prog rock as well. Both Ben and Lawrence are proud alumni of the University of Illinois, where their musical journeys began some time ago, and I'm pleased to have witnessed the magic they make together and separately, and I'm very pleased to call them my friends as well. Ben, Lawrence, welcome back to On the Arts.
Thank you, David. So much. Yeah, great to be here.
Well, as I mentioned in the introduction, this is a broad spectrum concert, multiple genres. Knowing Lawrence's creativity and thinking outside the standards box and your gift of storytelling, Ben, I'd like you to share a bit about your creative process and putting the set together.
Well, I suppose I'll jump in. I called Lawrence because I had a date booked at Birdland in New York and I didn't have a collaborator. And I was almost 100% certain that he would say no, but I said, hey, would you ever consider working together? I've got this date. And he said yes. And so we were off to the races. And you know, frankly, we didn't know each other very well. So we started to get together just a handful of times at his house in Queens, just outside of Manhattan. And we found that we had such similar musical tastes, you know, not just in the records that we listened to growing up, but also, you know, Lawrence, I hope you don't mind if I speak for you a little bit. Your father was he was the head of a theater program at an East Coast university, which instilled Lawrence with a deep love of Broadway from a very young age, and I, of course, you know, love to dabble in the Broadway repertoire and the Great American Songbook. And then we discovered this love, this common love for rock and roll and prog rock, and started just creating a massive list of songs that we wanted to choose from, and really had fun sort of, you know, just in the course of four or five meetings, coming up with a really fun evening of music that we've now done in New York and Chicago, and we're excited to bring it to the West Coast.
Lawrence, what do you want to add to that in terms of winnowing down? I mean, lots on the cutting room floor, so to speak, I imagine.
Well, you know, it's kind of like doing a jigsaw puzzle. If you think about it, like one of those really big ones with 1,000 pieces, there are so many songs that tell so many different stories. And once you start a narrative thread, then it's really sort of a feast of riches, or whatever the saying is. But you want to pick something that seems like it flows out of the last song, which sometimes could be the way in which one thing flows into the next can be a surprise. It can be a little bit of a left turn, but if it's a left turn that makes sense, we all have left turns in life, so that does happen. But between thinking of things that have minimal, at least, harmonic potential to be interesting, because from my viewpoint, if you break down modern popular music, which includes to me rock and roll, pop, or you know, Barry Manilow pop, or whatever, there really are kind of two types of songs in a broad sense, and one of them is something that still has interesting harmonic activity in it, and then the other one is your sort of two chord, just not very harmonically interesting selection. And so there's plenty of entries in the former group, and that's kind of, we just looked at it, and songs that we loved that seemed to work with the narrative that also had interesting aspects to them musically, and then there you go. You got a tune list.
So what sort of, I don't know, what do you want to call them, liberties or reinterpretations are you taking to what will be mostly, I imagine, familiar tunes to most who attend? It is all on a harmonic level that you're adding some, you know, stereotypically blue notes and going off in different directions?
And it depends on the song. There are a couple of songs that we're doing that it worked out for us to utilize a little bit more intricate arrangements that I had done in the past. And so in those cases, we're getting adventurous enough to the point where the listener will have that experience of going, I know this. What is this? But it won't be until the real hook line comes that they place it. In other instances, because there's just the two of us, I didn't even do a chart. We're just doing something that we know. And in that case, I'm just kind of, you know, I make the joke, you know, I should have multiple checks in the mail to Herbie Hancock and Keith Jarrett and people like that. I've just sort of reharmonized things on the fly, remembering that my motto is never the same way once. So,
yeah, one of the really fun things for me, I mean, obviously I get a front row seat while we're doing this duo show to see one of the great jazz legends and musicians, musical minds of our time to play some of these bridges, some of these transitions between songs. And to see Lawrence play almost the entirety of this show just from a set list. He doesn't really have charts or dots in front of him at all. And we have key areas that we've agreed on. But, you know, like Lawrence said, where we chose songs to put on this set list, it was, you know, what's the song where some songwriter was feeling the same way as Billy Strayhorn, you know, like, and then you discover, oh, there's this Supertramp song where they're, you know, crafting the same story or sort of after the same feeling. And then, okay, we come out of that song and maybe there's a Richard Rodgers song that will take that thread to the next logical, you know, point in the story, and straight out of that into something by Barry Gibb, you know? And so it's just thrilling for, as Lawrence said, you know, we're doing songs that we know and that the audience knows and loves, but I'm up there, and it's, part of the thrill for me, as Lawrence mentioned, is to just sort of feel with him, find our way, you know, as Keith Jarrett might, or some of the other folks that Lawrence mentioned and is influenced by, you know, find our way to the next point in that journey, and sort of delight ourselves at the same time as we're trying to delight the audience with these songs that we all know, but we're not quite sure how we're going to get there.
Lawrence, that's what I love about what we're going to go out shortly with, a cut from your Tessitera release, Wichita Lyman. It just unwinds so beautifully. And then it's like stepping into a warm pool. Oh, that the tune. Wow. The journey that you took us there is just really something. So I'm hoping that audiences will experience that sort of wonderful discovery this Saturday. Ben, this is a busy time for you, coming up a Valentine's Day concert in Galesburg, Indiana, of your Sinatra-style show, Let Me Be Frank, before heading my way to borrow a phrase, for a couple of concerts. And see how I did that? For a couple of concerts in Palm Springs at the famed Purple Room Social Club on the 21st and 22nd of February. What are we going to hear for those sets called Temptation?
Oh my gosh. Well, that is another instance where, you know, I was using that thread of what tempts us, or another way of framing that question is, what do you want? You know, what do you want out of life? And there are a million songs, you know, about literally millions of songs about what tempts us in our lives. And so it was really fun crafting the set lists for those two sets that we'll do in Palm Springs. And that's with the collaborator that we already heard from, Ron Abel. And we'll have a band of folks who are West Coast musicians for those shows in Palm Springs. I should mention, David, before I forget, we have some late breaking news about this show in Oakland. You mentioned the 5:30 concert, but it has nearly sold out. And so we've added an 8 p.m. set. So there are two shows in Oakland with Lawrence and me. And I don't want to forget to mention that before we go out.
Fantastic. We'll have a late breaking bulletin for that at the end of our segment today. This just in. That's fantastic. Lawrence and I will both be attending those shows because Lawrence is going to be nearby for those. We'll have a nice reunion there. And then continue touring with this spring with a show called What Makes It Great, Lerner and Lowe, which you're doing in the New York metropolitan region for a couple of gigs with Ron Capello. Tell us a little bit about those shows.
Yeah, that's a series that Rob Capello has had going for a number of years, and he does all kinds of lecture concerts like this. He'll talk about Beethoven symphonies or Lerner and Lowe or Simon and Garfunkel or, you know, various composers, songwriters, whatever the entry point is, and he does a nice sort of 90-minute lecture concert. In our case with the Lerner and Lowe, you find me singing selections from Gigi, from My Fair Lady, things like that. And what we'll do is he'll lecture a little bit. We'll sing little snippets of something. And then at the end, we'll sort of put it all together performance style. And so I've done a number of those shows with Rob. He's got a great following and a lot of success in his career with those lecture concerts that he does. And that's right in line with his pedigree. He was a music director, I think, for the original Broadway production of Nine, I believe. I think I have that right.
Nice. And turning to you, Lawrence, you have a gift for teaching. And I don't say that lightly because it really is a gift the way you can offer your skills in that way, as well as performance. Where are you teaching now?
Well, I'm on a faculty at the New School in Manhattan, doing some short-term teaching of private students in Southern California. And that's I have a couple of private students in New York as well. An interesting phenomenon maybe of my teaching is that I've got any number of adult students that are themselves professional musicians, and some of them playing at a pretty high level within a certain genre choice, but they want to deepen their knowledge of either theory or orchestration, arranging and composing, that kind of thing. But the real classroom teaching I'm doing is at the New School. Right now, I've been concentrating on the connected issues of getting a fall tour together for my trio, which will, as usual, be anchored by a weekend at the historic Green Mill in Chicago. And at the same time, getting together new material for a new record. And then the other cool collaboration that's sort of, I guess, on a very light hold right now, I've been, in addition to working with Ben, the other thing that has been exciting to me lately is my collaboration with the singer Andromeda Touré, who's the daughter of the famous jazz trombonist Steve Touré. And some people might know her name because she's one of the main hosts on the Sirius's jazz weekend shows. And so that's also something that's going to be going into the studio. I just had a flurry of dates over the last, actually I was really busy in the fall and through Christmas. So now it's kind of like waiting for the next stuff to line up.
Sure, sure. And with Ben, you've performed a lot together. Any recording projects with Ben down the road, or?
Well, you know, I mean, we want to record this thing that we're doing right now in some form. And one of the things that Ben and I need to put our heads together and chat about. I think a lot of people are still sort of getting used to the new year, even though we're now towards the end of January. But there's always that, well, I've got to collect myself and figure out what's next. Now it's time to actually do that. But when we performed in Chicago, a friend of mine who's a former student came up to me at the end of the show. He goes, I want to produce this. I'm going to produce this record of you guys doing this. And we need to get back with him and see exactly what he has in mind. I think Ben would agree with that.
I am all in blind.
That's true love. Love is blind, as you know. That's great. Well, we look forward to that, as well as your shows down here. Looking forward to seeing you both together and in the desert, man. Lawrence, I was re-listening to one of the tracks, as I mentioned earlier, from your 2019 release, Tessitera. It has a beautiful, meditative, drawn-out introduction before we hear what is a familiar tune, Wichita Lineman, one of the tunes most associated with the late, great Glen Campbell. Tell me why you chose that tune and why that treatment.
Well, I have a penchant for converting what most people would call modern pop song, pop and rock song, into a jazz environment, which to me really only means that you change the nature of the groove a little bit, however, case by case, and then put it in a situation where it's possible to improvise over it. And the short answer, David, is that I had the idea to do Wichita as a sort of a lush jazz ballad a few years ago, and I just loved the song. And even I was surprised at the reaction that it got from people, deeply moving to people and evocative. And so it's just sort of become a mainstay of the repertoire. I play it with the trio. I do it solo quite a bit. And so when it came time to plan the repertoire for Tessitera, it was a no-brainer. It was definitely one of the ones I wanted to do.
Well, I think we're both of an era where we remember the Glen Campbell show and that tune on TV, as well as the pop charts.
Well, I was just talking the other day with somebody about how there was this whole list of songs, Carole King, Elton John, Simon and Garfunkel, whatever. And I was saying to a younger person, yeah, see, I remember when that was a hit, a new hit.
not Muzak.
Yeah. And back then it was like, you know, there were only a few radio stations that would play stuff like that in any given locality, and it's sort of same as the way TV was back then. So you focused on those, and it's one of the hallmarks of life, I guess, is to look back at stuff that you, like I said, you were there when it was a current, first time in its life hit, and now it's considered some sort of a real classic.
Right.
You know, 40-some, 50-some years later, whatever.
Well, I'm sure that's the kind of creative reinterpretation I imagine folks will hear this Saturday at the Piedmont Piano Company in Oakland, as pianist Lawrence Hobgood is joined by the beautiful vocal stylings of Ben Jones for their 5:30 performance, and this just in, added an 8 p.m. performance. Here's Lawrence Hobgood and company and Wichita Lineman. Gentlemen, have fun Saturday. And Ben and Lawrence, I'll see you in a few weeks down here in the desert.
Indeed. Thank you, David. Thank you, Ben. See you soon.
Thank you both. Thanks for having us, David.
That's On the Arts for this week. Going out with the music of Lawrence Hobgood and Wichita Lyman. As always, our shows are archived at kalw.org. My thanks to producer Janice Lee and to Damian D. Minor for running the board and myriad cues involved in today's show. I'm David LaTulipe. You're welcome to comment on the show to me directly. I'm David at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.